Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. We're in the sixth week of our fourth annual Franchise Legal Series. My guest today is Lane Fisher from Fisher Zucker, and we'll be talking about effective financial performance representations, also known as Item 19s. I would like to thank last week's guest, Mark Kirsch from Great Plant Moody. We had a great discussion about outsourcing franchise sales. Next week, Jonathan Redgrave will be my guest. We'll be talking about e-discovery, and then, of course, we'll wrap up the fourth annual legal series on May 30th with Dean Heil from the IFA, as he'll give us a legal symposium, the IFA Legal Symposium recap. In June, we'll be moving our series to the franchise model. June 6th, we'll be talking about consumer marketing. Ed Waller, the co-founder of CertaPro and the 2012 chair of the Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference, will be my guest. Followed on June 13th, we'll be talking about operations and franchise relations. Mary Thompson, this year's award, Bonnie Levine Award winner, president of Mr. Ruder and part of the Dwyer Group, should be my guest. On June 20th, Robert Stidham from Franchise Dynamics will be my guest as we discuss franchise sales and development. And we'll wrap up the month with Amit Mitra from FranConnect as we discuss technology and franchising. We're starting to really line up a good series for the summer, our new Franchisor Spotlight series. We'll do 9 weeks in a row talking with various franchisors and how they've utilized best practices to bring their brand to the level of success that they're achieving today. In September, we'll move forward with the Public Affairs Month, wrap it around the Public Affairs Conference by the IFA. And then, of course, October and November will be entirely about franchise sales and development as we try to center everything around the West Coast Franchise Expo in Anaheim and the Franchise Update Leadership and Development Conference, which will be in Buckhead again in December. We'll wrap up the year with a year in review. Just a lot of great things going on in franchising. I just spent the last 3 days in Atlanta at the IFA FranCap Digital Marketing and Technology Conference. Unbelievable information from one of the editors from Wired Magazine from the UK, as well as the vice president from Google. Just tremendous things on the horizon. Coming up, speaking about the horizon, coming up in June, two big events you don't want to miss. The IFE event in New York, the International Franchise Expo, as well as the Franchise Consumer Marketing Conference by one of our strategic partners, the Franchise Update Media Group. That'll be in Buckhead at the Ritz-Carlton in June, and we'll talk more about that in the upcoming weeks. Of course, I always want to thank our strategic partners along with Franchise Update Group is Fishman Public Relations. I mean, Brad and Sherry and Deborah Vilches and Sarah Schulte over there do a great job helping us with Franchise Today. And then, of course, helping us with some of the technologies, Elements Local, Jeremy LeDuc, Michael Boyer, and the team over at Elements Local. So as we move forward today, Lane Fisher is my guest. He's returning for the fourth time in our legal series. In private practice since 1989, Lane currently represents more than 75 franchise brands in business transactions and complex franchise litigation. He's admitted to practice in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and serves on the Franchise Law Committee of the New Jersey State Bar Association, the Philadelphia Bar Association, and the American Bar Association's Forum Committee on Franchising. We know him very well in franchise circles, very active member within the IFA. He serves as a member of the IFA's Board of Directors and is past member of its Executive Committee and a past chair of the Executive Committee, the Supplier Forum Advisory Board. He's also chair of the Legal Symposium Task Force, serves on the FranPAC Advisory Board, is very instrumental in driving membership with the IFA, speaks at a lot of the conferences. Lane, welcome back to Franchise Today.
Thanks so much, Paul. I appreciate that warm introduction. Thanks for having me.
Lane, also before we get into today's segment on effective financial performance representations, I just wanted to talk real quick about Unconference. We didn't have anybody report back this year about the Unconference. If you could take a minute or two and kind of give people an overview of what it is, what happened this year, and where it goes from here.
Well, thanks for that opportunity. So as you know, Brad Fishman and I and our respective firms put on an annual event in Park City, Utah, centered around skiing, called the Franchise On Conference, which is sort of the premier networking event and the only event of its type in terms of how much of the event is dedicated to conference room style programming versus how much of the event is dedicated to opportunities for networking in unusual circumstances. Folks come back year after year. We had just over 200 people, which is very close to the cap on many venues in Park City. So we may either have to relocate or hope we don't grow much bigger. But I think that that number of people and the intimacy in a group that small creates unique opportunities to get to know people. And in a circumstance where most of the attendees are presidents or founders or CEOs or senior executives from franchise companies that are all at some measure facing the same kind of challenges and issues, it's a unique opportunity for them to network and talk to other folks who are similarly situated and at the same level and to collectively brainstorm solutions. It's a great, great event, and we hope, you know, the listeners that aren't already fans of and devotees of the conference join us next year. Paul, I guess while I have the floor, I'd also like to mention that Brad and Fishman PR and my firm and Entrepreneur Magazine have a new event. It's called the Springboard Event for Emerging Franchisors. It will be offered for its first time on September 25th and 6th in Philadelphia. It's a two-day event. It'll start in the afternoon one day and conclude in the afternoon on the following that next day, Thursday. It is a founder and senior executive-driven program where they're shepherding all the programming and designing it directly to be beneficial to emerging franchisors. So we're envisioning that we'll have more than 100 brands that have somewhere between 0 and 150 units attend. It will be, I think, an amazing event and a really great opportunity to really talk to all disciplines of franchising and all the things sort of franchisors must consider as they begin to grow their brands and, you know, when the tipping point is for outsourcing or insourcing something that was previously outsourced, and supply chain and finance and administration and certainly franchise sales. So we're hoping lots of folks join us for that. We're to waive the $250 registration fee for folks who register by June 1st. So anybody who wants to take advantage of that should let us know.
And where would they register, Lane?
The link will ultimately be live in the next day or so on franchisespringboard.com, and there are various ads appearing in Entrepreneur Magazine that also contain the link to register.
Okay, great. Well, I look forward to participating, especially since we're working with 10 emerging brands. I hope to be there, and I think it's going to be a great event. I think it's well needed in the franchise community. So anyway, definitely look forward to that. Always look forward to visiting with you and Brad and in the great city of Philadelphia as well. And I think that along those lines, a segment on financial performance representations, I mean, certainly it can be focused around emerging brands, probably needed more than others as far as an understanding of it. We know there's a continuing trend in the world of franchising to be able to tell candidates more about, you know, the earning potential. In item 19 in the FDD, we know that's the section that provides details on earnings, costs, and other factors likely to affect future financial performance after a candidate signs on the dotted line. Today's franchise prospects, obviously being more sophisticated, technologically advanced than ever before, are finding a lot of the information themselves online. It amazes me, talking with candidates of late, that one of the first things that's coming out of their mouth these days is, when do I get the FDD? They're becoming increasingly sophisticated in their search process, with more and more looking for hard numbers to give them deeper insight into the earnings potential of a franchise brand. Some franchisors provide these representations Others refrain. I think that could be a whole course of another conversation. Some are concerned about the legal liability about making such claims, and I think the importance there to know is being able to back up those claims, because when done properly, the FPRs do provide a competitive edge as a sales tool. So starting out, Lane, who should be involved in the development of a Item 19 or an FPR?
Well, let me just to dial back for 1 second to something you just said. I think that the law provides what I'll describe as a safe harbor for making financial performance representations. And so long as your FPR is based on historical operating results, there's very little you can't actually say. It's for the franchise prospect to decide whether or not he or she could attain those results, because after all, the franchisor doesn't really know at that point. And again, as to the folks who refrain for fear of creating legal liability, I mean, while the system, while the making of earnings claims is not a risk, or financial performance representations is not a riskless process, I think that the cases demonstrate that the more information you give somebody, the more difficult it is for them to prove that they relied on some other, you know, more glowing or inconsistent statement that they heard somewhere down the through the sales process. So
absolutely, thanks for that clarification. Yeah.
So to answer your question, I mean, it's the question is, you know, who should be involved in the creation of an Item 19, and what's just in terms of if I had to make an observation about most companies' standard operating procedure, earnings are assembled really more or less at the last minute in contemplation of updating and refiling someone's FDD, and usually are the brainchild of the CFO and the lawyers, and which is a way to get it done, and it probably is a way to capture all the historical performance. But in our opinion, that process begins way too far down the pipeline. In other words, the process should begin with talking to your frontline salespeople, people who are dealing day-to-day with prospects, and trying to understand what their fears are and what the obstacles to them moving forward are. In many cases, those fears, by way of example, is people will be fearful of how long it will take them to break even, which is translated to that they may run out of cash. They fear how long it will take them to get started, or how much the cost of a manager or a person who is perhaps skilled labor might ultimately cost them, or what if they were doing sales, what their closing rate might be, or if they'd be effective at selling, or what the failure rate is of units, or the volume of business that comes from any source that comes through the franchisor. You know, those are things that if you debrief most frontline salespeople, most fears will come into the economic category and the doing business category, right? I'm going to not have enough money, yeah. I'm going to run out of money, or I'm not going to get enough business to be successful. And sure. if you understand that, and you understand what exactly they're fearful of, you can start this process by trying to figure out whether, frankly, you have any metrics in your system that actually show that those fears are unwarranted, right? If the fears are unwarranted and you have empirical data that would show that, then it would be a good tactic to put that information out there up front in a way that it's dealt with as an opportunity rather than as a, you know, a sort of obstacle or, you know, something that gets in the way of the sale. So
sure.
We think that people should begin this process, frankly, much earlier than it typically starts, and involve the franchise salespeople to figure out what tools they need to be better at their positions. And that those tools would, in many cases, involve potentially additional Item 19 information that helps them counter the objections that they face on a regular basis.
You know, over the past, I think it was in year one and two of the franchise legal series, we talked about Item 19. I remember one of the shows was financial performance representations, friend or foe. And many franchisors, certainly not as many as there were several years back, but there's still a good number of franchisors that will not put together an Item 19, obviously not include an Item 19 in their FDD. What is your opinion as to a franchise organization that refuses to include an Item 19?
I mean, we encounter folks all the time that are of that mindset, although I would describe that subset of the population as getting smaller.
Absolutely.
More and more, when your competitors all have an item 19, it becomes very difficult to sell against them under the notion that you can or choose not to make those similar representations so that they can compare opportunities, you know, on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm.
The one that gives them more information will more likely get a more thorough investigation. I think that folks, look, there's care that goes into presenting an item 19. And again, as I said before, it's not riskless. You have to document all your material assumptions and you have to make sure you carefully define what it is that you're saying. But by framing it in your, you know, official and often many cases registered document, again, you make it much more difficult for a disgruntled franchisee to say that that person reasonably relied on a salesman, let's say, promised that they would make $1 million if all of the information in front of them says that historical unit performance is something less than that. So the more people, and frankly, as the sales process gets more congested and more people participate in it, either through brokers or third outsourced franchise salesmen, or larger in-house sales departments, the more we think a necessity it is to have a barometer against which to measure whatever oral representations you hear along the way.
So in what detail should a franchisor present gross sales or P&L information?
You can answer that a number of different ways. You should say, I could answer it, you should present whatever you have. Recently, I had occasion to look at 100 different item 19s from companies that I would describe as rapidly growing. And what my observations are as follows. The more mature franchisors, who I think may offer less in terms of exclusive territories or, you know, special deals, I think, or at least I'm seeing a trend toward them disclosing more information down closer to a net income type measure, whether it's net income or EBITDA, earnings before interest and taxes, depreciation and amortization, or net cash flow. But I see the trend toward them trying to disclose information which is closer to a bottom line. And I guess my observation would be that they're sort of mitigating the relative less of an opportunity by demonstrating that their units perform in a more predictable measure, at least historically.
You know, and this is probably more of a question for our friend Ron Feldman. But do you know if the SBA is weighing differently funding through franchise organizations that have item 19 or don't have an item 19? I know we didn't prepare for that question, but that just came to mind.
I mean, there's an SBA registry angle to that question and just how lenders generally look at it. I think that, you know, the FDD is the single best and most detailed source of information on the franchisor. It would stand to reason that lenders would view a more detailed item 19 more favorably than one that chose not to disclose anything. I'm not aware of an SBA requirement that you have one, so I don't know that it disqualifies you from SBA not to, but I can certainly tell you that the growing trend in financing, which is obviously what SBA is relevant to, is to include more detailed item 19 information for lenders.
Sure, absolutely. We were talking earlier about emerging brands, and a lot of startup brands obviously don't have, many of them don't have the financial history to put together a very strong item 19. What is your recommendation to those franchisors that don't have a large amount of financial information but still have some type of financial information? Is it your recommendation that they still proceed and try to put together the best item 19 that they possibly can?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's a place for item 19 for emerging brands, and I think that fewer emerging brands, in my experience or in the sample that I looked at, would detail down the net income. And so let's just talk about the universe of potential claims. So there's gross sales type claims, and we know they just obviously state average unit volumes in terms of gross sales. There's defined gross profit, where it takes gross sales and then also identifies the major categories of expenses and calculates the bottom line with respect to that. And then what we see and what we've seen a lot of creativity in, and this is really probably the best learning to come out of my little study, is that whatever your business is, if you're successful in franchising, there is some favorable metric that you are performing well at. And what we see is there are many measures which are short of defining what your annual gross sales will be, which would present the business in a most in its most favorable light. And so people, if you were, for example, if you were a restaurant and you were trying to demonstrate the relative productivity of your drive-through of your catering business, you know, separating that information out separately as a subset of gross sales would be relevant, but also defining how many catering jobs you do or what the average value of a catering job is, or talking about what the average ticket is for a customer who comes in. Because I might come in to your restaurant and look at your menu board and think that, you know, if a sandwich is a dollar, that that's what the revenue would be per customer. And if we know the average revenue per customer is higher than national averages, and we would, you know, ultimately present that as well. But I think that there's all sorts of numbers. I see service businesses defining, like, that they're trying to define essentially the cost or value of acquiring and retaining customers. And they talk about, you know, the volume of recurring revenues, the volume of repeat business, the quantity of renewals, perhaps revenue from national accounts, revenue from a franchisor's website referrals, revenue from a call center, average revenue per job, average cost per job, but ways which try to profile the business not in terms of its annual performance, but in terms of some either more limited time period or in some cases per job.
You know, recently, as we're working with various franchise brands, especially as we're onboarding some, we've been calling, representing ourselves as a mystery shopper, trying to get information out as we're trying to get a better understanding of their franchise sales process. And in many occasions where they haven't had an item 19, of course, there's this claim that's made by many franchisors in this position that say, oh, we're not allowed to give out that type of information, which we know is not correct. But many have said, you know, talk to our franchisees. They can give you a better representation as to expenses and costs and what they make. What would be your response to a franchisor that says that that's what they do?
Well, okay, so as to your first point, that people for years held hid behind a veil of, I'm not allowed to give this information, or I'm precluded by the FTC from giving this information. And in 2008, the FTC sort of dealt with that head on by saying, you need to make an affirmative statement that you're allowed to give it and that you choose not to. So now everybody's on the playing field, at least that they're, if it's not provided, it's because somebody's making a conscious choice. The notion of referring people to your franchisee base to talk to about the underlying business opportunity is really the alternative, right? So you send people out to test. You know, in many cases, it's like validation. It would be like, if you had it to do all over again, would you? But then people, of course, get more specific in their asks about the particular performance of the business. The problem with that, with those calls, is that you're calling, you know, the number of the unit, and you're talking to whoever answers the phone. You don't know whether it's the principal or not, and even if you got to the principal, you're not really getting the context. If you ask people, what is your electric bill, or, you know, what did you do in gross sales today? Like, that's a relevant piece of information, but it really doesn't tell you how long ago they open. Maybe they're open 10 years, or maybe they're open 10 minutes, but you don't have a framework in which to evaluate the information that you're getting. And so you can ask all those questions and try to get it from each person individually, but the likelihood that you get disparate information and information on differing time periods and information which isn't comparable from an apples-to-apples standpoint is high. And you don't know whether the information will be reliable or the information will adequately frame the prospect's expectations in terms of ramp-up, right? Because maybe it took a while to get to that level of gross sales. But if you're not asking all the right questions, you may just get a snapshot in time that isn't, you know, all that relevant. So, yes, you can send people to your franchisees, and we always tell people, call as many franchisees as you can and have as detailed as conversations as you can have. But, you know, there's always a problem reaching folks. In smaller systems, sometimes these existing franchisees are inundated with calls. And often, you know, there's you know, an incomplete picture of either the income or expenses or any of the other information that would otherwise be provided. As opposed to, Paul, if I gave you that information in your FDD in item 19, I believe that the exercise would really be confined to calling around to see if franchisees fall within the ranges that you've disclosed, but wouldn't necessarily delve into the detail that you might choose to present in your item 19. So I think that it shortens the process dramatically and ensures that the most relevant information is in their face. And that, you know, I was thinking just a minute ago, if you're talking to the oldest franchisee in a size location that we don't even do today versus talking to somebody who's got the flagship 2013 unit, I mean, you wouldn't on the phone or looking at a list of stores know or understand how many seats are in that restaurant or how many customers are out if a business has six territories or one territory.
Sure, and if there's a item 19 and it's a well-crafted item 19, certainly, to your point, the conversation with the franchisee would be a lot more concise to find out if they fall within those parameters, and therefore franchisees might be more inclined to want to talk with candidates, and obviously that helps the validation process a great deal. In allbusiness.com, Andrew Caffey wrote an article a while back, and he started out by saying, Catch 22, Area 51, Apollo 13, Form 1040, and now Item 19. And I chuckled when I read that because he's lumping them in, obviously, with a lot of unknown areas, a lot of areas that are reek of being of precarious nature, etc. But when I read it, what I specifically started to think about was, yeah, I could see how Item 19 falls into that category, as we might be talking about brokers being involved in the equation. If you might, give us some of your thoughts with respect to item 19s as they are intertwined with the broker relationship.
It's interesting. So yeah, I don't know that I would define them necessarily as unknown. I think that to the extent that you have data, and again, that's the challenging part because some people don't have the data, that and you disclose all your material assumptions, that I think the framework for doing an item 19 is well established, and I don't see it as that unknown. I would say insofar as it relates to brokers, it would relate to my comment earlier that the more folks that you have involved in the sales process, so if you go to use a broker network and pick up, you know, anywhere from, I don't know, 100 to 300 people now representing your brand, you have now, you know, incorporated the potential representations of all those people into your sales process. So, again, to create a barometer against which folks can measure what they hear on the street is, I think, a risk mitigation tool, because I think without one, you don't know what the franchisee is going to hear. And with one, maybe you still don't know what the franchisee is going to hear, but you've given them something or her something to compare it to decide whether it's reasonable or unreasonable. And, of course, folks who know that this data is published, who are in the franchise organization or otherwise related, you know, wouldn't be inclined necessarily. I think it curtails abuses because I think people see that the information is right there in black and white, so they're less inclined to go off the reservation, if you will, with respect to what they say.
Sure. With respect to the level of information, the amount of information that's provided, are you finding that more mature franchisors are disclosing more information?
I mean, I think they are. I think that they were reluctant all along, and frankly, I think that they were at a level that they generated their own interest and didn't need to give an earnings claim or an item 19 in order to be effective. But I think as more mature brands have over time embraced the item 19 concept, because the landscape has become more competitive and there's new up-and-coming brands that offer lots of information. So now you're called on the carpet with respect to relative productivity has driven people to present information. Sometimes it's competitor-driven, sometimes it's market opportunity-driven, and sometimes it's internally, you know, it's some business-specific attribute that is being highlighted to demonstrate superior performance.
We are live on Franchise Today. We're in the middle of our fourth annual legal series. My guest today is Lane Fisher, partner at Fisher Zucker LLC in Philadelphia. and we're talking about effective financial performance representations. Lena, I received a question from our audience, and you know we have a lot of people that are new to franchising, just getting started in franchising, and obviously we have a lot of people that have many years of experience. And the question was asked is, you know, what was the origin of the item 19 and why was it necessary to put in with the new FDD rules?
Well, I think the problem was in the late 60s and early 70s when franchising became sort of more popular that there were, you know, a lot of different financial representations being made to people to induce them to buy franchises. And ultimately the FTC rule was passed, I think, in 79 after, I think, California and a couple other states enacted laws that essentially said you can't make any representation about earnings or profits unless you make it in this particular format in item 19 of the FDD. So what they were trying to do was make sure that folks documented whatever assumptions they were making. We always tell folks to start with your whole sample of units, and then to the extent that you present less than the sample, identify each criteria upon which you use to strike out certain units. So if it's, I'm only showing units that are 1,500 feet or greater, you'd be striking out ones that were smaller than that under the theory that you only offer units that are 1,500 square feet or greater. But there was a lot of fraud, and the genesis was it was completely unregulated. People were selling franchises on the back of, you know, matchbooks with very little information and disclosure, and so the financial information came along with all the other required disclosures with respect to, you know, the principles and termination and all the other things that have to be disclosed in the FDD.
What would your recommendation be to a franchisor that would come to you and say, you know, Lane, we're on a four-year spiral, a downward spiral of operating performance at the unit level, and we still want to put in an item 19. How would you even begin to guide them in that regard?
Well, I mean, it depends. If your downward spiral may still be at the top end of the industry, it just may be lower than it was before. So in that case, you know, it still might not be unfavorable when compared to others. But it's a challenge. When numbers are going down, you don't really have much of a story to tell except for one that is negative. The place where an FPR has the highest utility is when you begin to enact remedial changes that fix things, and you can demonstrate a, you know, spiral or a rebound back in the other direction. And I think many folks attempted to identify when their systems turned around by using this kind of information or providing this.
I think that's a great point, because I think there's a lot of franchisors out there that think I could only put the information in one type of format, and they look at what's typical. But and correct me if I'm wrong, because I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, but there are ways to kind of think outside the box to be able to highlight the points, either differentiation from competitors or as the brand is making changes and are able to show that with real factual numbers.
Well, and let me jump in there for a second, because I think that that's right. So if you have a system that's in decline, and let's say it's a system that sells services, it could be a printing business or any kind of business like that, and you looked at your system and you saw that some units are, because even when you have system-wide averages, there are still ones which generally move in the other direction. So you look at your top performers and try to figure out why. In some of our client systems, for example, units were able to rebound faster if they brought in an outside salesperson. They weren't required to under the contract. We couldn't make them, but we could try to demonstrate the business case for adding them by essentially showing the productivity of an outside salesman and perhaps even the cost. So if you know an outside salesman costs either some fixed commission rate or $35,000, and you knew they generated additional gross sales of 100, that would be an amazing thing to disclose to try to get folks to embrace, you know, to embrace the concept of bringing on outside salespeople. Similarly, if there is some new piece of equipment, let's say that you're going to have smoothies in your business otherwise that you didn't before, and you can demonstrate that units that that put your smoothie concept in, and let's say the smoothie machine costs $5,000 or whatever it might cost, we're generating an extra $30,000 in gross sales. Those kinds of things would be favorable and viewed as favorable to prospects. Again, you're trying to show where you have a relative edge over the competition or where you have a relative edge over your prior business model. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we see people doing that all the time and using item 19 without even going into gross sales or, you know, full measures of like that, but going rather into the specific elements of the fix that are causing gross sales to go up. And I might then profile all the units that have an outside salesperson or that offer the smoothie product together, trying to show that their month-over-month sales are growing or their year-over-year sales are growing at a rate faster than the rest of the system, because I'm trying to demonstrate relative efficiency. If we're doing catering or off-premises catering and that becomes a way people are leveraging their fixed assets, again, but it can't be required, or you're choosing to bring people along voluntarily rather than by forcing them, demonstrating the productivity of that line of business would be a good way to try to move people into it.
Certainly there's a lot of people, and obviously this is not just unique to franchising in all business circles, that are not quite familiar with their way in and around financials, P&Ls, balance sheets, income statements, etc. And of course, item 19 can be looked at somewhat in the same light. Recently, we did a test with the permission of three CEOs of franchise brands that allowed us to test their franchise salespeople. One was, in each case, they had three individuals. One was the VP or held similar position in franchise sales and development. One was a franchise salesperson, and another was a broker that worked with them. And I had mentioned this once before or twice before in this series, and I want to emphasize it again here today because I think it relates to the question. In those cases, we took a 20-part multiple choice test about the FDD. And it obviously didn't get into some of the legal terminology or looking at, you know, dispute resolutions clauses and termination clauses. It had to do with factual numbers. It had to do with, you know, the amount of the franchise fee, discounted amounts if they bought more than one unit, the range of initial investment, just various points of the FDD that are used typically in the sales process. And when we got to information about the item 19, well, first of all, across the board, we had 8 of the 9 franchise professionals fail the test on a scale of 70% being passing. And the CEOs were really alarmed by that. And the only question that was answered across the board correctly was, how much is your franchise fee? So it's really alarming that we have information in the FDD that is not known or known well by the people representing the brand in a franchise sales process. But now take it to the item 19, and a lot of people not having an understanding of financial reports and numbers, et cetera. What would your recommendation be to a franchisor as far as how they train or how the franchise salespeople are trained with respect to understanding how to explain the item 19?
I think that's a good question. I think that there's perhaps not enough of that. I think that, again, in my process, it begins with the salesman, and they're involved in it all along the way because you're trying to give them a vehicle to tell their story. It is critical that whoever leads development be able to explain, and I think be able to walk a prospect through what your item 19 says. You don't really want the lawyer who wrote their will to be the first one that walks them through item 19. And, you know, in my world, people walk people through item 7, right, what it costs with all the fees. And then the next logical place to go is how our franchisees have performed historically. And that's sort of how you tell the cost-benefit story. I would leave it at that.
What is the various item 19s that I've seen, you know, talk about actual financial results when some relate to projections? What would your thought be between both of those, projections and results?
So projections, it always come up. while you can make an item 19 based on projections, a projection is your best estimate of what, or best projection of what a franchisee will do. And that's, in my view, the wrong side of the telescope to be on. I don't think you know, or there's enough data to know what a prospect his or herself will actually do. Because you don't know the level and extent to which they'll follow your standards, whether they'll come to work, whether they'll hire efficient people, whether they'll hire all their relatives, whether they'll follow your site selection criteria or anything else. So you're really much better served by talking about what people historically have achieved in the business. Now, projections often come up in another context, that a franchisee takes your item 19, puts them into either a templated spreadsheet that you gave them or one that they prepared themselves, and sends it back to you with a, what do you think, or, you know, here it is, or some kind of thing which tags you with their projections of what they will do. And I think that's another moment where you need to take pause and deal with that, right? So you can either just ignore it, which leaves no paper trail to close it out, and I don't know how folks will describe what, how people may have responded verbally to it, or to write back to say, I got your projection, and you know, I don't have any basis by which to know how you'll particularly perform, and you need to make sure that you review it with accounting or legal professionals of your choice to, you know, to aid you in this exercise. But you don't want to be saying you think they'll do it, because once you say looks good to me, which is the logical and intended reply, then you're saying to them that you believe that they'll perform at that level, and then when they don't, you maybe find yourself in litigation claiming that you promised them that they would achieve a higher number.
Sure. So the old handing them a blank performa, fill in the numbers, and say you do the math is certainly not acceptable today.
Well, I mean, look, I think people hand out blank proformas with the categories of expenses filled in. When they start incorporating formulas so that you put in sales, for example, and the cost of goods sold come up in some number, which even if it's consistent with item 19, is not the way to do it. You can't populate it with formulas. If you do, you need to take it to your lawyer and make sure that you're not overstepping your boundaries. And you don't, in my view, give it to them filled in, right? So it's just a blank spreadsheet that show the categories of expenses so that they realize there's a licensing requirement, if there is one, or a local requirement in terms of zoning or other thing that might require payments or other fees, so that they pick up those payments. But and when we do it, we include a whole bunch of disclaimers and exculpatory language at the back end that talk about the purpose of the form and that we're not able to approve it, and you know, that give you some give the prospects some direction with respect to how to use it and who to collaborate with, and that they should get advice on the outside.
Certainly, the FDD is a legal document, and item 19 is a financial representation within that document. But altogether, and I believe you mentioned this in one of the first two shows we did on FBRs, and you said it's a great marketing tool. Not only the franchise disclosure document, but obviously the FBR. What are your recommendations, or what are your thoughts behind it being a marketing tool and used as a marketing tool?
Well, again, you know, an FDD is itself a federally or state required disclosure document, so it really prescribes and limits the amount in which you can embellish items to make it really a sales tool. But when we talk about it using it as a sales tool, we talk about creating measures in item 19 that folks can use to help sell franchises.
Sure.
But I would say, to more directly respond to your question, that if you have an item 19 in your FDD, and many of us have seen in the back of the Wall Street Journal and other publications where folks open their advertising with essentially their average unit volume or their net income, and to the extent that you can capture a prospect's attention by putting your operating results directly, you know, front and center in your solicitation materials, some feel you'll be more likely to pique the interest of folks. Many companies are aggressively seeking existing, let's say, multi-unit operators from existing systems. And, you know, this kind of information can be helpful in that vein.
It was interesting that Molly Rowe from Franchise Business Review wrote an article called Fear Not, the Item 19, and it is interesting perspective in here, where she says honesty is best. The purpose of your item 19 should be to educate prospective franchisees about what they can expect as an operator. It should not be to sell franchises. you might be tempted to paint the picture a little rosier to include only information that tells a best-case scenario. But in today's business and climate, full disclosure, obviously, is always better in the long run. You want franchisees who make you money, which means you want franchisees who knew what they were really getting into from the start. Really an interesting perspective saying, you know, don't use it to sell franchises because it really does make sense. The more opportunity the franchisees have to make money and they have good, strong unit economics, obviously those are the type of individuals that you want in the system.
I guess I agree with that in part and not in part. I think that you use an item 19 or a purpose and a noble purpose is to manage expectations. And I totally agree with the issue of transparency and painting a picture. But as a practical matter, you can't present these other positive attributes, or there at least are issues with whether you can present them, unless you present them in item 19. So if you have some kind of amazing closing rate with respect to customers, the only place to put it is item 19. And I would argue that that actually will help you sell franchises and all of these things, talking about how quickly folks get to either a certain number of customers. Like Planet Fitness always talks about getting to 5,500 customers, you know, being some meaningful milestone in your economic performance. But being able to provide that information is extremely helpful, and I think it does present the full picture, and I would argue is educating them in the performance of the business model. You need to understand the business model, where there are opportunities for profit, and how you might maximize them. And I think that using the item 19 to try to highlight those areas of exceptional performance are extremely relevant. So I'm not sure I agree in total that it's not a sales tool. I don't like calling it that, and that's become more a term of art. But I think that you can, in having this conversation with your salespeople and in looking at your business model, that you can identify positive attributes of your business model that you would be well served by including in your item 19, so that you can say it in any case, or say it in advertising, or say it, you know, in any other context which might give you a leg up or a point of differentiation as compared to the competition.
You know, recently the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Kentucky issued another decision demonstrating the dangers of franchisors relying on disclaimers in their contracts and the franchise disclosure document to defeat claims that it provided false financial performance information in selling a franchise. And that was the case of Long John Silver's Inc. versus Nicholson. The court denied summary judgment for the franchisor of A&W Restaurants and allowed the franchisee's claim of fraud and violation of franchise sales laws to be decided at trial. Are we going to see more and more cases regarding item 19?
I mean, just because we live in a litigious society, and we always saw cases about item 19. And in fact, when the trend was not to have one, every franchise litigation included some claim that somebody violated item 19. I think that, you know, as I said, it's a detailed process where you have to carefully document your assumptions and keep substantiating documentation. And I don't doubt that along the way that franchisees, there might be reasonable minds might differ on a particular matter, and somebody might ultimately, you know, deal with the earnings claim or deal with statements made outside the earnings claims in terms of its, you know, if you say one thing, it doesn't mean that you can say everything under the sun. And if you're only saying a very limited item, it could be that people, you know, go beyond the scope of it or say more than precisely what's contained in the FDD. So we live in a litigious society. I suspect that item 19s will still be an element of litigation. But in terms of what we see, Paul, in terms of typical fraud claims and promises, you know, in the old days, the claim was always somebody promised me I'd make $1 million. We see that those claims, absent other facts, are much more difficult to demonstrate the critical element of reliance, meaning it was reasonable to rely on that promise that you'd make $1 million, when the, you know, triple-bound, you know, official FDD that's filed and approved by states says, and so we have believed and used it and seen many other franchisors use it as a risk mitigation tool. Because somebody didn't get out on summary judgment doesn't mean that they won't ultimately prevail. Summary judgment's
right.
A high standard, and it throws somebody out of court. So, I mean, I would say that even the, you know, the ink isn't dry on that, you know, ultimate resolution itself. So, I mean, things happen, but I think you actually reduce the exposure by having one in there. And, again, I'm not advocating that you take too aggressive a posture. You can only be as good as your data. But, you know, we've seen people who lack some critical piece of data. And even in this sample that I looked at, I think 7 or 8 companies went back out to their chains with surveys asking them to fill in missing pieces of data. And in all cases, you know, the next year they were able to create a much more complete picture of, in that case, the expenses associated with, you know, the underlying business. And so, you know, if you don't have it, it doesn't mean that you can't get it. Surveys are reliable and sort of very recognized tool to collect these things, as long as you believe the information you're getting is reasonable and it's consistent with information otherwise reported to you, and, you know, you're allowed to use it. And I think people are more and more using it, either in some cases driven by what competitors are doing and what they're disclosing. I see in, like, the wing business, there's new measures of profitability that seem to be embraced by multiple companies in an effort to compare themselves to one another. Lots of creativity in this area. But I think that, you know, in many congested markets, like yogurt or like burgers or like home health care, identifying your points of differentiation and being able to highlight them as part of your sales process and part of your, you know, award process is critical, because I don't know how else you get visibility in what is a, you know, crowded landscape.
I like that. I mean, I think the points of differentiation are really key and can be used quite effectively. You know, the interesting thing about this case, and I'm not here obviously to talk specifically about the case, but just as I was reviewing it when an article came out about it, was that the franchisee, this was the fourth franchise he had bought through the franchisor. And the obviously the business model had changed some, and that was part of the issue at hand. And I think that's probably a good warning, or will generate a good warning to franchisors when they're awarding a franchise, a multi-unit franchise, to somebody that's been in the system, that might have even been in the system pre, you know, 2007 with the new FDD, and hasn't seen the new FDD and hasn't seen an item 19, or maybe the franchisor just takes for granted the fact, well, you know, he's been a successful franchisee. Let's just, quote unquote, put him through the process and award him a new franchise. So I'm sure that's definitely something to be concerned about.
Well, yeah, I mean, and changes in business models. I mean, I believe that the most relevant item 19 information is information relative to the kind of units that you'd award today. But if I'm only awarding units today that are 1,500 feet in a pad site, that the more limited population of 1,500 square foot units in pad sites will be the most relevant to present in the item 19. But then, again, if I'm not sure I would include data from stores that don't meet that selection criteria. And if I think it would take the range and make it much to be much larger than it would otherwise be. So I see Cousin Subs refers to it as their highly efficient unit, but they use that term to refer to the units that they're currently selling in their size, shape, and footprint. And I think they may have more than one model, so they may have a mall model and a pad model and a, you know, inline model, but their highly efficient terminology refers to the kind and size and shape units that they're offering today, which presumably are their most profitable ones. You know, as systems are refined over time, they try to figure out what the optimum number of seats and optimum sizes, and as they get closer to it, that becomes, you know, more they more narrowly define their selection criteria. But I think that folks often use item 19 to describe the new model, the highly efficient model, and frankly how it outperforms the old model or other old models or the average unit volume of the hodgepodge of everybody mixed together. But we're seeing many people try to identify the performance of their, quote, highly efficient model in more detail going forward. So, yeah, systems change, Paul, and I think that the way people did things, you know, there's a lot of private equity, a lot of companies changing hands, a lot of systems evolving at a necessity, right, just to meet competition or customer needs or the Internet. And I think, you know, people need to systems need to be flexible, and that I think would even apply to folks who bought more than one and who over time are obligated to sign the new form of agreement and adopt the new standards and specifications. I mean, that seems reasonable and logical to me because the system has evolved to have a, you know, a different or more efficient unit, and that is what the person bargained for who bought the multiple units at one time.
Absolutely. And to the point of multiple units, have you seen in your experience specific item 19s specific to multi-unit operations?
Well, as a matter of fact, I have, and even especially in the sample that I looked at. There were, I think, 8 or 9 companies that made earnings claims specific to multi-unit operators over and above or as distinguished from single-unit operators, presumably and intentionally to develop or identify the efficiency or the income or the profitability or productivity that comes with multiple units. So, and some people used it as a way to demonstrate performance. So they took like average gross revenue, they separated single and multi-unit, and then the multi-unit they separated like one's open more than 3 years and one is open less than 3 years. So they're trying to show and did show that the multi-unit operators outperform single-unit operators in a shorter time period. Some people also present multi-unit operators as some subset of the whole community and you know, show the relative numbers for that subset. Others talked about this, and I thought this was interesting, Paul. The average number of units owned by franchisees open more than 5 years. So what's that supposed to say? That's supposed to tell a prospect that if you're in our system 5 years, you have more than one unit, right? So they and it was like 2-point-something units or something like that. But it showed that people liked the one they had enough to buy a second, at least, and were on their way to their third. So that was interesting. Average number of years in business to show that people had been in business under this business model for a long period of time. Like people went to great lengths to, and this is slightly different, but to demonstrate the percentage of franchisees or not lack of failures or lack of failures among multi-unit operators. So, and again, and in multi-unit operators and service businesses, folks went beyond and were trying to identify, you know, other metrics of those multi-unit businesses or multi-story businesses in terms of their volume of government accounts or national accounts or customers or, you know, bit larger customers that were in those bigger territories.
Right, and certainly it's a great differentiation factor when you're dealing with a lot of today's more financially astute individuals looking for the opportunity to build an enterprise, ergo build a multi-unit operation. That type of information is probably what they're looking for.
Yeah, it shocks me that people, if you ask them who they're targeting, they will say existing franchisees of other non-competing systems, but when you ask them what data they have for multi-unit franchisees that might get, you know, get them some attention, the answer is usually none. And if you ask them further, what special training do you have for multi-unit franchisees or special dashboards or benchmarking information or other stuff that they might be accustomed to seeing in their other systems, I always find that those issues are not as well thought out as I would like.
And, of course, you know, we have 90 seconds left, and we could have talked a lot about a lot of different things with respect to this. And obviously, we'll just have to leave it for another show. I didn't even get a chance to ask you about financial performance representations within social media, but I think we could spend an entire show on that. Lane, I really appreciate you coming back again on Franchise Today, and certainly I really am very appreciative to all you do for franchising. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. And again, just people with just one lesson is that they should, before the next time their FDD rolls around, have a small session with the folks in the franchise development team to try to identify what of these measures and what attributes to define and differentiate your business from your competitors and see what data you have that could be incorporated in your item 19. You'd see with all this information, you create a great story for salespeople to tell and unfold in front of the prospect that will be, in my view and in our clients' views, more effective.
Great information. Thanks, Lane. I appreciate it. Next week, my guest is Jonathan Redgrave. We'll be talking about e-discovery Until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.